Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to welcome David Dallin here to speak on his book, Jewish Justices of the Supreme Court. David is a San Franciscan, and a very intelligent one, I must say, because he balanced the local rivalry extremely well. Well, he went to Lincoln High School, then he went to UC Berkeley for undergraduate. He got his PhD from Brandeis, out of the city. But when he came back, he was a Taube Fellow teaching at Stanford. So, you know, he covered all of his bases here. And let me tell you a little about what he's done since he got educated. He's a historian and a rabbi, and the author, co-author, of editor of 11 books, including Religion and State and the American Jewish Experience, and The Presidents of the United States and the Jews. His articles and book reviews have appeared in a variety of publications, including American Jewish History, Commentary, Modern Judaism, The Weekly Standard, The American Jewish Yearbook, and The Jewish Review of Books. Here to speak about what's a very interesting history of how it got started and what preceded it. I think the chapter where he precedes the thing and says how it built up to the fact that we could now have Jewish justices was also very interesting, the 100 years, how any institution, how any group moves forward little by little, moving up until they get what they ought to have had long earlier. David Dallin, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me thank, well, first of all, it's great to be back in San Francisco. Any excuse to be back is virtuous. And I want to thank George for organizing this. I usually don't bring a cane with me. I'm recuperating from knee replacement surgery, and it's been, as a great San Francisco Giants fan, I'm finally reconciled to the fact that I'm not going to have the Major League Baseball career I wasn't going to have anyway. But I'm somewhat, you know, acclimating to that reality. But anyway, also, I've already met so many friends, but just there's one, I can point out, Hal Friedman. We were a generation or two ago undergraduates at Berkeley together when both of us didn't have as much distinguished gray hair as we have today, and it's been great to meet several people here, and it's always good to come back to San Francisco. So I'm delighted. I'll keep my watch here. I'm not going to promise that I'm going to follow it religiously, but at least it'll be an incentive. Anyway, you know, in American government and public life, Jews have played the greatest role in the judiciary. There's still never been a Jewish president. Some of you know, of course, that Joe Lieberman got probably as close as you can get. I'm living in Florida now, so that says something about something. But to become vice president, there's never been a Jewish Speaker of the House nor a majority leader of the Senate, although Chuck Schumer, if the Democrats take the Senate in 2018, would be the first Jewish majority leader of the Senate. And although there have been more Jews, and I've written about this before, in Congress and the Senate, you know, there was until very recently, California had two Jewish women as senators, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, et cetera, et cetera. But the area in which Jews have really had the greatest role has been in the judiciary. Over the years, since Brandeis was appointed, which I'll talk about, Louis D. Brandeis, to the Supreme Court in 1916, there have been not one, not two, but three Jewish justices on the court. And had Merrick Garland been permitted, I don't know what the word is, had he been appointed, which he, of course he wasn't. Many people, by the way, didn't realize that by the name Merrick Garland that he was Jewish. There would have been four out of nine members on the court that are Jewish. Now, what's amazing, by way of introduction, when Brandeis, I'm going to tell you in a minute the couple of themes I'm going to talk about, but when Brandeis was first appointed in 1916, it would have seemed unimaginable that, number one, there would ever be three Jewish justices on the court and two Jewish women on the court, but also that there would be a Supreme Court without a Protestant justice. Some of you may know that until Antonin Scalia died last February, there were six Catholics and three Jews. And now, of course, Neil Gorsuch, some of you may know, is an Episcopalian. So it kind of returns the Protestant, to the court, which there hasn't been since 2010, since the appointment of Elena Kagan. But I must tell you an interesting thing about representation, not just in religion, but in terms of geography. You know, it's often presidents try to appoint, justices from the East Coast, from the West Coast, the Midwest, the South. There's this tendency to try to balance the court geographically. How many of you are from New York? Okay. You may or may not know that until Justice Scalia died, four out of the five boroughs of the city of New York were represented on the court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg from Brooklyn, Justice Sotomayor from the Bronx, Antonin Scalia from Queens, and Elena Kagan from Manhattan's Upper West Side. Only Staten Island has never had a justice. What can one say? And speaking as someone who's Jewish and a San Franciscan for the first time, I'll talk about Steve Breyer a little later, but Steve Breyer, of course, is the first San Francisco Jew to be on the United States Supreme Court. But that we'll come back to afterwards. There are two themes in my book that I wanted to just discuss with you and hope I won't try to give too much away from the book, so you'll buy a copy. But the two major themes that I think are really important, one is the role of anti-Semitism in the earlier years, both in Supreme Court appointments, in Senate confirmation hearings, and especially in the legal profession. If you were starting out, you could be at the top of your class at the greatest law schools in the 20s and 30s and not get a job in the private sector. And the decline of that. And then also I want to talk about a little bit about the so-called the Jewishness of the Jewish justices. We assume, when talking about Jewish justices, that they all were, very identified Jewishly. You know, Antonin Scalia was a very devout Catholic justice. And it's always interesting to hear what the Jewish lives of the Jewish justices were. And my other hat, I'm an ordained rabbi. It's a family business, although I've never had a congregation myself. And that's kind of an interesting dimension of this, too. But let me start with the other, with Brandeis's nomination. And Brandeis, as I'm sure many of you know, I've spoken to some people, is the only, certainly Jewish Supreme Court justice, and actually the only justice, I think, after whom a great university has been named. Now, when Brandeis was nominated by Woodrow Wilson in January 28th, to be precise, 1916, it was one of the most bitter and contentious confirmation hearings in the history of Supreme Court appointments. In fact, it was the most contentious until the nomination of Robert Bork in 1987. By comparison, the Gorsuch nomination went by rather quickly. Now, some of the opposition to Brandeis certainly had to do with his being a radical, progressive economic reformer, someone who vocally opposed big business and the business trusts, and was considered persona non grata, although he was a very prominent corporate attorney, actually, in Boston. He made a fortune in those days. He could retire essentially by his mid-30s, but he was eventually persona non grata by the business and legal establishment in Boston. But a lot of the opposition had to do with the fact that Brandeis was Jewish, plain and simple. Now, by the way, to give you a sense, before going into the opposition to him when he was nominated, even on the Supreme Court itself, there was a Justice James McReynolds, who had earlier been Attorney General of the United States. He was a noted anti-Semite. He refused, if he was walking on one side of the street and Brandeis was on the other, or vice versa, he would walk to the other side. There are two famous portraits of the Supreme Court in the 1920s that lack his photo because he would not sit and have his picture taken in a photo that would include Justice Brandeis. And he notably read the newspaper or did something else. They didn't have cell phones then, of course, when Brandeis was reading an opinion. And when Herbert Hoover had the audacity to appoint another Jew, Benjamin Cardozo, and I want to come back in a minute, to the court, he sent a scathing letter pleading with the Senate and Hoover not to, I forget the actual word he used, to afflict, it was, the court with another Hebrew justice. And by the way, you should know, the eight Jewish justices, in case you don't know the names, were in the following succession: Brandeis, then Benjamin Cardozo, then Felix Frankfurter, then Arthur Goldberg, then Abe Fortas, and that was till 1969. Then skipping a while, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993, Stephen Breyer, 1994, and Elena Kagan in 2010. Now, the response to Brandeis's nomination by pundits and others was immediate. William Howard Taft, the former Republican president of the United States, who had hoped against hope that Wilson would transcend partisan differences and appoint him, Taft, to the court, spoke out, led a movement to, and Taft, by the way, was not actually anti-Semitic, but he was outraged that someone who he respected so little as Brandeis could be on the court. And he had a famous press conference in which he called Brandeis a muckraker, a socialist, which that in those days was, you know, the worst you could say, with a great power for evil. And he said he just couldn't imagine that as a lover of the Constitution, Wilson could do this. Now, he brought together a group of six former presidents of the American Bar Association, including himself and Elihu Root, the former Secretary of State, to sign a petition opposing Brandeis's nomination. But so that was one person. He lent a lot of his stature. Now, the other person who led this movement was A. Lawrence Lowell. Now, I don't know how many of you recognize the name. He was the president for many years of Harvard University, Brandeis's alma mater, a noted, noted is a good word, I guess, for this anti-Semite. He had been one of the founders and the national vice president of the Immigration Restriction League. And he later achieved even more infamy by trying to introduce... Do I need the microphone more? I'm sorry. I'm even without my cane, I tend to be a little bit... okay, is this better? Can you hear me a little better now? I'll try to... Is there a... Can I hold this on? Yeah. Well, I'll try to just keep it near me. Okay. He introduced a quota on Jewish admissions to Harvard in the 1920s. Now, he brought together a petition with 55 of the most eminent members of the Boston legal and business establishment, including Charles Francis Adams, Jr., the president of the Harvard Corporation, the grandson and great-grandson of two, a different Adams family from television, but of two presidents of the United States. And it was a who's who of the Brahmin establishment in Boston. And they brought that to the attention, and that played a role in the nomination debate. Now, it's interesting to note, one of the people who supported Brandeis was the Irish Catholic mayor of Boston, John Honeyfitz Fitzgerald. Now, if the name rings a bell, Honeyfitz Fitzgerald was the grandfather of John, his namesake, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And it's interesting that later on, and John F. Kennedy was very close to his grandfather, and he later said that when he became president, his appointments, he would like to follow the model of his own Supreme Court appointments, to follow basically in the footsteps of Justice Brandeis, to appoint somebody like Brandeis. So anyway, Brandeis was... you know, after a heated battle, he was confirmed finally, and he was the first sitting Jewish justice. And this started, maybe we can talk about later, a tradition that would start really in the 30s, more of a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. And later in the 1920s and 30s, there began to be a tradition of a Catholic seat. And then in the 1960s, with Thurgood Marshall's appointment, an African-American seat, although many African-Americans were not particularly pleased when Clarence Thomas was appointed to that seat, a little bit different. And then, of course, now there's at least, there'll always be at least one, whether it'll be a seat for a Jewish woman or at least for one, if not more, women on the court, too. So you have began this tradition. Now, just one interesting footnote here. When Brandeis was on the court, and his daughter was hoped to be a lawyer, and she had graduated at the top of her class at Bryn Mawr. So, you know, he was a justice of the Supreme Court, so he called the deans at Harvard, Yale, and Columbia, all good friends of his, who were more than happy to defer to a justice on the court. And they said, and he said, well, you know, my daughter Susan is, and that was her name actually, did brilliantly at Bryn Mawr. And, well, and they all said to him the same thing. You know, Mr. Justice, we would love to have her as a student, but regrettably, we haven't started admitting women yet. And it won't be for at least another decade. So she ended up going to the University of Chicago Law School, not a bad law school, which was one of the few major law schools at that time that had admitted women. And she became a prominent lawyer in her own right. Now, it's interesting to note, just by the way, parenthetically, there have been 8 Jewish justices. 7 out of the 8 were appointed by Democratic presidents. They were all what we would term liberal or progressive lawyers in their careers prior to the appointment. Now, the one Republican, Herbert Hoover, appointed Benjamin Cardozo. Now, this is interesting. Cardozo was the chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals. He was widely considered to be the greatest judge in America, not sitting on the Supreme Court. But he was a lifelong Democrat who had actually publicly supported Al Smith against Hoover in 1928. And yet there was such a groundswell of support for him that Hoover nonetheless appointed him. And, you know, Hoover didn't have one of the great presidencies, although he became, of course, a California resident later on. He lived his last years. I went to Herbert Hoover Junior High School in San Francisco. But and yet many of his biographers have said that one of his greatest achievements was appointing Justice Cardozo to the Supreme Court. And he came to feel the same way. So, and now there was, Felix Frankfurter faced a great deal of opposition. One of the Republican senators, and by the way, his attorney who represented him at the Senate hearings was Dean Acheson. And by the way, Louis D. Brandeis started the tradition of appointing Jewish law clerks, which had never been a tradition before. And Acheson, who he was very close to, was one of his most famous non-Jewish law clerks, but very close to he and to Frankfurter. And Frankfurter at the time was the only Jewish professor at Harvard Law School. He served for 25 years from 1914 until his appointment in 1939. And one of the most powerful Republican senators on the Senate committee, you know, accused him of being a communist. And now, mind you, having Dean Acheson as your attorney and being accused of being a communist was a bit of a stretch, even then. And just put him on the spot. He had been a supporter of Sacco and Vanzetti. Many of you have heard of who are the anarchists in Boston. He had written actually a famous article in The Atlantic in defense of them. So nonetheless, he was confirmed. But here's an interesting thing. You know, with Supreme Court appointments are so important because they far outlast the presidents and the ideologies of the presidents who appoint them. You know, that's why Neil Gorsuch is 49 years old. Elena Kagan was the exact same age. She had yet to turn 50 when she was appointed. And that was considered important that if with good health they could serve on the court maybe for 30 years or so. Now, it's interesting, though, some presidents come to regret their decisions. Dwight D. Eisenhower appointed a conservative Republican governor of California by the name of Earl Warren, who had been the vice presidential running mate to Tom Dewey in 1948. Thinking he was a good conservative Republican, he turned out to be the greatest civil libertarian of the 20th century. And Eisenhower later said in his memoirs, the greatest mistake of his presidency was appointing Earl Warren as Chief Justice. Now, I would suggest to you, I would guess, if FDR had lived, he would have said the same about Felix Frankfurter, because although Felix Frankfurter started out as a left liberal progressive, he became more and more conservative over the years. And by the time he retired in 1962, he was the most conservative member of the Warren Court. So, you know, people do change. And that's interesting in terms of perspectives of why presidents appoint the people they do appoint, and especially the age at which they appoint them. It sometimes doesn't always work as planned. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about the anti-Semitism. Felix Frankfurter, I have, by the way, 38 wonderful photos, I must tell you, in my book, and one that's never been published before. I would say they're all wonderful, but one is of Felix Frankfurter in his Harvard Law School dorm room in 1905. I don't think this has ever been published before. Anyway, Felix Frankfurter graduated number 1 every year at his class in Harvard Law School. He had the greatest letters from the dean of Harvard Law School, all his professors. He could not get a job in any big city law firm. Now, this was 1905, 1906. In fact, he famously, as I recount in my book, had a lunch at the Harvard Club in New York with they were just a few months apart, another ambitious young law school graduate by the name of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And it established a friendship that would last 33 years till FDR appointed him to the court. And they were all mapping out their kind of strategies for political careers. But the point was that one firm after another turned Frankfurter down. Finally, he was offered a position, and I forget the exact name, it's in my book, by one of the most blue chip, Wall Street firms, never before hired a Jew. And before they offered it to him, the senior partner took him aside and said, "Well, you know, son, you're so brilliant. You've got such a great future. May I suggest that you change your name? It's just a little bit, anglicize it a little bit more." He was trying to be nuanced on this. Well, the fact is, as I'll talk about after, Felix Frankfurter was not a particularly religious Jew by any stretch of the imagination, but that he wouldn't do. His father's name, he would not. He told the senior partner he couldn't do this. He was still hired. He left eventually to then work for Henry Stimson, who was then in the War Department, and started his career in government. But so that's one of several stories. Now, in the 1930s, Arthur Goldberg, who would be appointed by President Kennedy, first of all, Secretary of Labor, in 1961, and then to the court to replace Frankfurter, and Abe Fortas, who would succeed Goldberg, they graduated law school at around the same time, 1929 and 1930. Goldberg from Northwestern Law School and Fortas from Yale. Now, there was always an aura around Brandeis. It was said, by the way, Brandeis graduated Harvard Law School. He started at Harvard Law School at the age of 15, a little bit precocious, and he graduated at such a young age that he had to get a special dispensation from the state of Massachusetts to be admitted to the bar. But he is reputed to have graduated with the highest scholastic average in the history of Harvard Law School before or since. And it may be apocryphal, but the same was said about Goldberg at Northwestern and Fortas at Yale. And yet neither one could get jobs in law firms. In fact, it's ironic. Arthur Goldberg started off in a little law firm that had been founded by two brothers with the name of Pritzker, if the name sounds familiar. This is the Hyatt Hotel chain family. Penny Pritzker was Secretary of Commerce under President Obama. One of the cousins lives here in San Francisco, et cetera. It was a small Jewish law firm. They branched out into real estate holdings and hotels a little later. But he could not get a job at any of the major firms. Now, it's interesting. He graduated number one in his class. 3 years earlier, a man by the name of Adlai Stevenson, whose path would cross with Goldberg later on, graduated very much in the amorphous middle at Northwestern. Yet, because of his yichus, he came from one of the oldest established, families in Chicago. He got one job after another in firms that Goldberg could never aspire to. Now, and then Goldberg eventually became the preeminent labor lawyer in America. He negotiated the merger between the AFL and the CIO, and then he was appointed by John F. Kennedy as the Secretary of Labor. One of his first cabinet appointments after Kennedy's election. Now, Fortas also was considered to be one of the greatest students in the history of Yale Law School, and his mentor was William O. Douglas, who would later himself be appointed to the Supreme Court. Excuse me, one second. And he, too, though, couldn't get a job at a law firm. So with Douglas's recommendation, he started out of the New Deal, and he advanced. Eventually, he became one of the whiz kids. FDR brought Jews into the New Deal, Jewish attorneys who could not get jobs in the private sector. And he eventually became the Deputy Secretary of the Interior before 1946, branching out on his own, starting one of the big Washington corporate firms. It used to be Arnold, Fortas, and Porter. And for years later, we'll talk about, you'll read in my book about somewhat the one scandal in all of this when Fortas resigned from the court. They took the Fortas name out of the firm's. But it was a very interesting thing. He got a job there. And he started out on a very illustrious legal career. Now, I should tell you, he had some good luck along the way. He, in 1948, there was a young congressman from Texas by the name of Lyndon Johnson, who Fortas had met in the New Deal. And in the race for his life, Lyndon Johnson was running for the U.S. Senate in one of the closest races. Had he lost that race, we never would have heard of Lyndon Johnson. The race was so close that there were 1,500,000 votes cast or more. They got a blue-chip committee of attorneys from Washington, headed by a young attorney by the name of Abe Fortas. And Fortas went to the Supreme Court to argue it and was decided in Lyndon Johnson's favor by 87 votes. And Lyndon Johnson never forgot that. And he was always, Abe Fortas, before he became, was on the Supreme Court, was probably, I would argue, the most influential Jewish presidential advisor in American history. And it later would produce, I may come back to this, some controversy. It was said when he was on the court that he spent more time in the White House than he did in his Supreme Court chambers. And by the way, one of the footnotes in all of this, some of these justices, Brandeis as well and Frankfurter, spent a lot of time doing what's called extrajudicial activities, like drafting legislation for presidents, which you're not supposed to do when you're on the court. In fact, Abe Fortas drafted LBJ's 1966 State of the Union address. Another no-no. But Brandeis, you know, secretly helped draft much of the early New Deal legislation. But that's another story. I'll read it in the book. But it this became, and this was his road to prominence. His law firm then became the favorite law firm of the majority leader of the Senate in the 1950s. He and his wife, who was quite a, a personality, I'm trying to think of the right phrase for her, to give you a sense, she had 150 pairs of shoes in one closet alone. Who's in Sex and the City? Who's the actress who had, something like this, Sarah Jessica Parker. She outdid Sarah Jessica Parker. They drove twin Rolls Royces. Now, in the 1950s, she was a partner in the same firm. They were making over $400,000, which was a lot of money then. It's a lot of money now, but especially then. And by the way, and I may come back to this, Abe Fortas was an amateur violinist, and supposedly the story goes he'd be chauffeured to and from every place in Washington by his on his Rolls Royce playing the violin in the back seat. But that's another scene. And just one last thing about this, because it's interesting. He became so influential that his wife would not permit him to accept an appointment to the Supreme Court. He had turned down LBJ's offer as attorney general. And when LBJ, they had considered themselves socially very friendly, Lady Bird and LBJ and the Fortases, when LBJ, behind her back, supposedly, without consulting her, had the audacity to appoint her husband to the court, he had to take a 90% salary cut then. She called him on the phone in the White House, and this has been attested by several sources. No one ever heard anyone speak to Lyndon Johnson the way she did. She was outraged. She said, "How dare you? We thought you were friends. How can you do this to us?" Et cetera, et cetera. This is covered in quite a bit of detail. She was somewhat of a piece of work herself, which I tried to be charitable to her in this book, but part of it. But you know, you'll read a little bit more about that. But anyway, so Abe Fortas, who started out unable to get a job in any big city law firm, became not long thereafter, probably one of the most influential attorneys in the United States. Now, between the 1930s, when Goldberg and Fortas started out, and the 1960s, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who, of course, by the way, is, of course, you know, from San Francisco, many of you know, when they started out, and later Elena Kagan in the 1980s, it was a different ballgame completely. By that point, Jews were much more accepted in the legal profession. In fact, as I talk about in the book, Ruth Bader Ginsburg faced opposition. She confronted opposition, but not so much because she was Jewish, but as a woman in what was, predominantly still an all-male, a predominantly male legal profession. In fact, there's a great story, a sad story, but in when she entered Harvard Law School in 1956, she was one of nine women in a class of over 500. She later became the first woman ever to become a tenured professor at Columbia Law School. But at the time, she was highly recommended by Albert Sachs, who was the later dean of, Jewish dean of Harvard Law School, to be a clerk for Felix Frankfurter. Now, this is 1959. Felix Frankfurter, who had faced such prejudice himself, said he could not imagine himself hiring a woman as a law clerk. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, when you think about it today, and he refused to even consider her. And it's interesting because he had the distinction of having appointed a little earlier the first African-American law clerk, but a woman he wouldn't consider. And it just shows how times have changed. This was, you know, 1959.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, each of these people did not face the opposition as Jews in the legal profession. Now, some of you may know something about Stephen Breyer. I have a wonderful photo in one of my 38 photos. It's his high school yearbook picture at Lowell High School, 1955, in which he was voted most likely to succeed. And there it says, besides being most likely to succeed, he was the star debater on the Lowell High School debating team. And he would often debate. His primary opponent in intercity debates was a young up-and-coming debater at St. Ignatius by the name of Jerry Brown. And they would meet and compete often in 1954 and 1955, which is just kind of an interesting piece of trivia. And he went to Stanford and then went to Oxford on a Marshall Scholarship and then went to Harvard Law School. And by the way, he has the distinction, interestingly enough, of being not only the only Jewish justice, but the only Supreme Court justice to have been married into the British aristocracy. His wife, Joanna, who is an Anglican Protestant, is the daughter of the former head, not of the Labour Party, but of the Conservative Party in England. He's part of the liberal bloc on the Supreme Court. And his father-in-law had several positions in Harold Macmillan's cabinet in the 1950s and 1960s. Come back to this a little later. And he had a great career. He, besides being a Harvard Law School professor, he commuted between D.C. and Cambridge. And he worked with Archibald Cox on the Watergate Committee, a committee becoming much more relevant today, perhaps. But he also became the chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee, in which he's always been known, Steve Breyer, for his affability. And he famously got along very well with both Ted Kennedy, the leading Democrat, and Orrin Hatch. And when a federal judgeship came up in 1980, just before Jimmy Carter left office, Hatch and Kennedy, who actually were very close friends, their friendship transcended politics, together persuaded Jimmy Carter to nominate Steve Breyer to the federal bench. And then in 1994, they came together one more time to persuade Bill Clinton to appoint him to the Supreme Court. And by the way, it's interesting to note that Bill Clinton only had two Supreme Court appointments. Both of them were Jewish. Now, what's interesting about these appointments is by the way, Steve Breyer has the distinction. He served as a law clerk together with Alan Dershowitz for Justice Goldberg in 1964 and 1965. And he has this distinction of being the first Jewish law clerk to have served as a law clerk to a Jewish justice to be appointed to the court himself. Now, what's interesting, though, when Bill Clinton nominated Ginsburg and Breyer, there was absolutely no mention of their religion. It didn't come up. It seemed to be irrelevant. Not even pundits talked about that. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg has talked about this. You know, the idea of a Jewish seat, before it was always in the press, there would be always a short list of candidates, and invariably most of them would be Jewish to succeed. And, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, well, of course, Steve Breyer and I are Jewish, but this is no longer an issue. So, too, when Elena Kagan, and I'll talk a bit about her in a second, was appointed in 2010, no mention of her Jewishness whatsoever. And her upbringing was interesting. You know, Steve Breyer came from an upper-middle-class family. His father was a prominent attorney. He was the attorney for the school board here. In fact, Steve Breyer still wears today a watch that the San Francisco School Board gave as a retirement present to his father when he retired as an attorney. But his father had gone, I think, to Stanford Law School. But he came from Frankfurter, who was impoverished, or Goldberg, or Fortas, came from certainly a well-placed middle-class family. And so did Elena Kagan. Her father was a Yale-educated attorney in Manhattan. And she graduated at the top of her class at Princeton. I still have a few more minutes, sir. The microphone. I'm sorry. Okay. I should have asked to have a handheld one before. Please keep telling me if I walk away from this. She first clerked for Thurgood Marshall. After Princeton, she was also, like Steve Breyer, a Marshall scholar at Oxford. And then she worked in the Clinton administration. She then became the first woman and the first Jewish woman dean of Harvard Law School, and then the first woman ever to be, it's the 10th Justice, it's called. Does anybody know who's an attorney here? The Solicitor General of the United States. She became the first woman Solicitor General in 2009, and then President Obama appointed her to the court in 2010. And that, by the way, she replaced John Paul Stevens, who was 90 years old, the last Protestant on the court for the next 7 years. So that's a little bit, and we can come back to this also, how the American legal profession has become much more open and, you know, to Jews than it was in a bygone era. Now, a little bit about the Jewishness of the justices. You know, a few of them were descendants of rabbis. Some came from Orthodox backgrounds. The one with the least Jewish background was Brandeis. His parents were German-speaking Jews from Prague. His mother was a free thinker who said that she loved the ethics of all religions, but the rituals or traditions of none, so to speak. And she celebrated. There was no celebration of Jewish holidays in their home, or they never belonged to a temple or synagogue, but they celebrated Christmas, etc. And so did Brandeis when he grew up. He actually married a Jewish woman, a cousin of his, but they, for the most part of his life, he was, he wasn't very much of a practicing Jew at all. In fact, he was a great letter writer. There are about 8 volumes of Brandeis letters, and 2 I'll share with you, which is just kind of interesting. In late December, before Christmas, in the year 1900, he sent a letter to his 2 young daughters who were visiting relatives in New York, and he said, please don't worry. When you get home next week, the Christmas tree will be here, and Santa will still be awaiting you. And the other thing was, he was very close to his brother Alfred, who remained. He grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, Brandeis. He never went back after law school. But his brother Alfred, every month, used to send him a ham from Louisville. Now, I've always wondered, there were no good hams in Boston. I mean, there must be if you pay enough. And there's a whole correspondence. Whenever Brandeis would get it, he would write his brother, oh, we're overjoyed. The ham just arrived. This is so wonderful. And to the surprise of many people, later on, you know, I talk about in my book, he became one of the leaders of the American Zionist movement. And he became probably, together with Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, as an advisor of Woodrow Wilson, one of the people who 100 years ago helped bring the United States to support the Balfour Declaration, which took place in November 1917. But he probably did more to help bring on the Jewish state of Israel than almost any other American Jewish leader. But even later years, he would surprise some of his guests, including rabbis who would come over, by serving his favorite ham to his company, which was kind of interesting. But the point is, so he grew up, and eventually his daughter, who had graduated Bryn Mawr, met a nice Jewish guy at law school who came from a more traditional family, and they started celebrating Jewish holidays. And later, when his grandchildren were, he would start, instead of sending only Christmas greetings, he would send, you know, greetings for Passover and for Rosh Hashanah as well. Cardozo came from a very eminent Sephardic family in New York, a very traditional one. He's the direct descendant of a rabbi, Gershon Mendes Seishas, who was the one rabbi who spoke at George Washington's inauguration in 1790. And he came from this eminent family, a much more traditional background. You know, he never really went to temple regularly, but when he did, it was always an Orthodox synagogue. Now, Felix Frankfurter was an interesting, a different story. Felix Frankfurter was one of the three justices of the Supreme Court who was not born in the United States. He came here from Austria as a young child, speaking not a word of English. He was precocious, a genius, etc. As a teenager, he left Judaism completely. He basically had nothing to do with it. He married the daughter of a Protestant minister. And he probably never set foot in a temple or synagogue except to give a lecture there occasionally. And yet, to the surprise of his Protestant wife and so many of his friends, in his will, he stipulated that the Kaddish, the traditional Jewish mourner's prayer, be recited, and that it be recited by one of his law clerks, Louis Henkin. Louis Henkin, who's not a household word today, died a few years ago, was a very distinguished law professor at Columbia University. He was one of Frankfurter's law clerks, a son of one of the most eminent Orthodox rabbis in America. And Frankfurter, the free thinker and, you know, the agnostic, really, always admired the way that Henkin practiced his Orthodox Judaism. And so he stipulated this, and he said to a friend shortly before his death, he said, you know, I came into this world as a Jew. Most of my life I haven't spent as a Jew, but I want to leave this world as a Jew. And his link to that was the recitation of the Kaddish at his funeral. By the way, just by comparison, Brandeis, did not have a Kaddish, what he had was a chamber music group playing Bach and Beethoven at his memorial service instead of the Kaddish, which says it's kind of interesting. Okay, now, going right along, the most probably Jewishly involved of all the justices, and that I've got some great photos for you, if any of you want to buy the book, was Arthur Goldberg. Arthur Goldberg. Okay, now, Arthur Goldberg was the only justice, unlike his predecessors, to have this is just a couple of weeks after Passover, to hold a Passover Seder in Washington. It was one of the events of the year. You know, I found in his papers at the Library of Congress, there were RSVPs from President and Mrs. Kennedy, from Ted Kennedy and his wife, from Hubert Humphrey and his wife. President Kennedy didn't come, but many of the other senators, Supreme Court justices did. Some of the great famous labor leaders who he knew, and it was an event in Washington, D.C. His seders really were. And it's interesting because he belonged to a Reformed temple. He wasn't certainly an Orthodox Jew, but he's the only justice who was a lifelong member of a synagogue who attended more than infrequently. But, you know, he didn't observe the Jewish dietary laws, but when he had these seders and when some of his law clerks were religious, he specifically arranged for, I have to go back here again. I'm so sorry. Keep standing up, George. I'm sorry to make you do that. Okay, you could all hear me better now. He arranged, in this case, Alan Dershowitz was then strictly Orthodox, and he was his law clerk. And so for Alan Dershowitz and a couple of others, he had the best-known kosher caterer cater his Seder in Washington. Now, this was interesting. He, on his Supreme Court letterhead, he wrote out the Goldberg family recipe for charosis, the traditional Passover dish. And my wife followed it. You can still use it today. It can still be a recipe that you can follow. And it's one of the photos in my book. And he also had the Goldberg family Haggadah always available. And it's really quite interesting. Now, In addition to that, there's some other great stories about Goldberg and his Jewishness. I'll come back to why he why he resigned from the court. But one of the cutest stories, which I must share with you, is when he was still in President Kennedy's cabinet. He's the only one of the Jewish justices who was a cabinet member before. He was Secretary of Labor. And he told the story often when he was visiting his elderly mother in Chicago. And his mother had been become quite active in several Jewish organizations. So one day, Arthur Goldberg was sleeping later. And the phone rang, and he could barely awake. He could hear his mother answer and ask, "Who is this?" And the answer, it was President Kennedy on the phone, and he said, "This is the president." And her immediate response is, "President New from what shul?" And he used to tell that story often. I don't know if President Kennedy told it often, but Arthur Goldberg always did. Anyway, so you'll learn a lot more about him. Now, the sad thing about Arthur Goldberg, had the shortest tenure of any justice. And to make a long story short, which if I had another 2 hours, I'd tell you about, but there's a whole chapter. Lyndon Johnson wanted to appoint his good buddy, Abe Fortas, to the court. So he twisted Arthur Goldberg's arm, and they said nobody could resist LBJ, to go to the United Nations. Now, nobody in their right mind, so to speak, leaves this lifetime appointment in the Supreme Court for an appointment at the UN, which is at the pleasure of the president. But supposedly Lyndon Johnson left dangling the promise or the suggestion that when Earl Warren retired, he would become Chief Justice, or there were several other things, or Goldberg was a great labor negotiator and he was a great opponent of the Vietnam War, that Johnson led him to believe that, well, maybe he would let him negotiate an end to the Vietnam War. Of course, that Lyndon Johnson had no intention of doing that, and they eventually had a falling out over the Vietnam War. But it was really very sad. Arthur Goldberg could have served on the court. He died in 1991, I think, for many years. But that you'll read more about. And I think it was one of the regrets. He never wrote a memoir. His family, his friends, everybody he knew counseled him not to step down from the court for the UN, but he said, "How could I say no to the president?" Anyway, Abe Fortas, you'll read more about. Abe Fortas, really to please his wife, when he took a 90% salary cut, and he was brilliant, he basically had to get some outside income. So he started taking speaking honorariums, which were not quite kosher while you're on the Supreme Court, and especially when one was funded by a Jewish financier by the name of Louis Wolfson, who happened to be Fortas's client, and Wolfson was then indicted and sent to prison, which didn't help Fortas's reputation on the court. And there's a whole host of things which led eventually to his resigning from the court after being nominated by Lyndon Johnson for Chief Justice. And by the way, you talk about people. He and Goldberg were great advocates for Israel during the Six-Day War. But one of the photos I have in my book is a picture of the whole National Security Council at a high-level Vietnam policy meeting. The only person who was there who shouldn't have been there was Abe Fortas. And he was advising Lyndon Johnson on Vietnam policy. By the way, his great love, I mentioned before, outside of law, was playing the violin. And he used to have a chamber music group of amateur and professional violinists in Shellis. They met at his Georgetown home every Sunday. He was very close friends with Isaac Stern, who's, of course, was a San Franciscan, and Pablo Casals. In fact, at his funeral, there were no rabbis, but Isaac Stern gave one of the most moving eulogies. So then we get to the most recent justices, and I'll talk a little bit about them and then maybe open up for questions. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was very happily married to her husband, Martin. He died in 2010. They were active somewhat Jewishly. They belonged to a synagogue in Washington, as did Elena Kagan. They would both go to services on the high holidays. They both, by the way, have the same physical. They both have the same trainer. What do you call it? What's the word for personal trainer, which is interesting. She's 84 and he's 50. She's 84 and Elena Kagan is 56, I guess, 57, but they have the same personal trainer. Now, Steve Breyer, who's considered usually often the more secular of the Jewish justices, but he's become a major voice for Jewish voice on the court since he's been on the court. And in 2003, when there was always been a tradition that the court would open, what is it, the second Tuesday? I always forget, the second Tuesday, the first October,
first week.
That's right. The first Tuesday after the first Monday, that in 2003, it happened to be on Yom Kippur. So he and Elena Kagan, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg asked that they were going to be in synagogue that day, and it was changed for them. Incidentally, Elena Kagan, who came from a much more Jewish background, I'll conclude with her, she and my wife were classmates at Princeton, and my wife still remembers her coming to the kosher dining room occasionally. But she had a very, she's broken glass ceilings for a lot of women throughout her career, particularly in the legal profession, but in another interesting way as well. She, when she was growing up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in 1972, her parents belonged to a new modern Orthodox synagogue called Lincoln Square. Some of you may have heard of it. It was the rabbi there, this very charismatic rabbi, Shlomo Riskin, now lives in Israel. Anyway, to make a long story short, in those days, Orthodox synagogues didn't have bat mitzvahs. And she was one of the star Hebrew students in the school, and she persuaded and persevered this Rabbi Riskin, and it was one of to have a bat mitzvah, which was one of the first bat mitzvahs ever held in an Orthodox synagogue in the United States, which is kind of an interesting story. So on that note, let me stop. I could go on for another hour, but I'm hoping that some of you will buy the book still. But let me, if there are any questions, or there's so many things I didn't discuss, but let me open up for questions if anyone has any.
I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to David Down, the author of Jewish Justices of the Supreme Court. And it is time for questions. Who would like to ask the first one? Anyone? I have a question about Brandeis.
Yes.
So you said that his nomination was the most difficult one until Bork's.
Yes. Probably.
And was it
definitely
was it disguised on issues or was it direct?
It was direct. You mean Jewish? The Jewish component was direct.
Yeah.
There was some issues. I mean, he was opposed by the Boston business and legal establishment because he was, particularly J.P. Morgan. The New York investor was a client of many of theirs. And because he had left his corporate practice he introduced the idea of pro bono work for lawyers, by the way. And there was a lot of resentment about that he had become, he was known as the people's attorney. He was probably one of the great progressive reformers. Then there were both Republican and Democrat progressive reformers. And that was considered, that didn't have a negative, it had a negative connotation in many quarters, especially in Boston. So, but that was certainly a component of it, but the Jewishness was even more so. In fact, Colonel House, who was Woodrow Wilson's closest advisor, was outraged when he heard about the appointment. How Wilson could do this without consulting him. By the way, Wilson wanted to appoint Brandeis as Attorney General first, his first term, and the anti-Semitism just became overwhelming, and he decided he withdrew the nomination. Actually, never was actually offered, but he remained devoted to the idea of appointing Brandeis to his cabinet or to the court. But something that you should remember, I want to conclude, by the way, with one thing about Merrick Garland. The difference, Wilson had one advantage. He had a Democrat at Senate to support him. So although Brandeis's nomination was controversial, he didn't have the same issue as President Obama had with Merrick Garland last year. He could push the other Democrats, and there were several progressive Republicans, like Senator La Follette from Wisconsin and other, who were progressives, but who were friends and supporters of Brandeis. So in that sense, he had it easier. And by the way, just about Merrick Garland for a minute, a lot of people didn't know he was Jewish either when he was nominated. This was completely irrelevant to his nomination. But your point is well taken. There was, had he been a good conservative corporate representative of the Boston corporate community, he might not have generated as much opposition. But some of that probably was irrelevant, mainly because of his Jewishness.
You mentioned in the book that some of his best friends from you know, like 10, 15 decades turned against him when he
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had great friends. So when he let me tell you a story of what social anti-Semitism was like then. He, when he graduated Harvard Law School, number one of his class, the number two was his friend Sam Warren. Now, Sam Warren came from this very, I don't know if the word is aristocratic, this Boston Brahmin family. They owned a major, they were millionaires, a paper mill and paper concerns. And his wife, Mabel, was the daughter of Senator Bayard from Delaware. Mabel Warren was, in that age, was viciously anti-Semitic. She refused to allow Sam Warren, she refused to invite Brandeis or his wife to their wedding. And she told Sam Warren that, well, if he really insisted, he could have lunch with him in town near their law office. But Sam Warren opened up all these non-Jewish clubs that were not open to any other Jews to Brandeis. But largely, a lot of the Boston establishment still considered Brandeis Jewish. And it was very interesting, and this is worth noting. In 1890, Brandeis and Sam Warren wrote probably one of the most influential law review articles ever written. It was called The Right to Privacy in the Harvard Law Review. And that came out, why? Because the local tabloid journalists were publishing these, you know, very tabloid-like stories about how the Sam Warren and his wife used to entertain with or spend all their money just... And Sam Warren's wife was very embarrassed about that. So mind you, she wouldn't invite Brandeis to her wedding, and she wouldn't socialize with him, but this he would do. She knew he was Jewish. He was smart. So they wrote this article about the right to privacy. Now, that was to keep private, you know, the eccentricities of, you know, the very wealthy in Boston. But later, it opened as the Dean Griswold, who was later Solicitor General of the United States, mm-hmm. of Harvard Law School, later said it opened up a whole new chapter in American law. But the fact was that Brandeis's, what you said, he, in his early years, most of his friends were not Jewish. It was only when he met Jews as he became a leader, and there's a whole story I could tell about how he became involved in the Zionist movement. But before that, and also the person who was, several people turned their backs on him, not only his wife's family, but I talk about Henry Lee Higginson, who was the owner of the biggest, wealthiest bank in Boston, who he and his wife had befriended Brandeis earlier, thinking that, well, he might be Jewish, but he was a nice guy. He was the most brilliant person in the history of Harvard Law School, et cetera. He later turned on Brandeis, and he financed the anti-Semitic campaigns against Brandeis when he was considered both for Attorney General and for the Supreme Court. And also one of Woodrow Wilson's, there's a Dodge Hall. I don't know if any of you have gone to Princeton or know Princeton. There's a Dodge Hall named after somebody Dodge, who was Woodrow Wilson's classmate at Princeton in the class of 1879. El Cleveland Dodge, his name is. And he also was tried everything he could to persuade Wilson not to appoint Brandeis to the court. So, yeah. But anyway, these people all turned against him later.
I think another very interesting thing about the book is that you talked about the ideas that they got started. Like yes. Right to privacy, which eventually was used in the Griswold case exactly. In the 1960s, right?
In fact, the person who drafted the Griswold case was Steve Breyer.
Ah.
Who drafted the original opinion in there.
I think you also mentioned that they started Harvard Law Review.
Yes. Brandeis financed the Harvard Law Review. It was founded in 1887. Yeah.
You mentioned that President Eisenhower regretted appointing Warren. But if I remember correctly, in those days, Warren could have run as favorite son from
yes.
California.
He could have.
And he didn't. And that was the payback that...
Okay.
What I seem to remember
yeah.
was
I'll tell you the
that,
story, yeah.
that he actually Eisenhower owed yeah. one to Warren, and that was his payback.
Well, there were two or three people he owed, and he wanted to keep Warren out of the presidential race. That's why, by the way, when I talk in the book, also why the governor of New York who ran for president in 1916. No, in 1916, he ran against Wilson. Oh, Charles Evans Hughes. he was going to be, he was, there was some consideration to appoint Louis Marshall, a very prominent Jewish leader, to the court in 1910. And Taft appointed Charles Evans Hughes because he feared otherwise Hughes would run against him for president in 1912. But that was one of the reasons. There were three choices that he could have appointed, actually, Eisenhower. One was Thomas Dewey, who turned it down. He finally wanted to make some money in law practice. The other was John Foster Dulles, who became Secretary of State. And the other was Warren. But you're right. It was possible that Warren would have run as a favorite son. But it's one of those interesting what-ifs of history. Yes.
Yeah, once Brandeis or Cardozo or were appointed, was any opposition later to their decisions because people were still anti-Semitic and criticizing that way, or they just criticize them for their political views at that point?
Well, both. I mean, this Justice McReynolds, who stayed on the court for many years, you know, I mean, he basically attacked and criticized every opinion that Brandeis made, even the dissents that he had together with Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who could not have been a more WASP justice of the court. And, you know, in fact, in the last, it's a tradition at the court, when a justice retires, you have a wonderful photograph that everybody attends, that's sent to family, children, grandchildren, etc. McReynolds, who retired a year later, refused to sit for that. So the anti-Semitism came in somewhat from the court itself, from one of William Howard Taft's former attorney generals, George Wickersham, who Taft later, by the way, disassociated himself from. But yeah, and there were attacks on some of their opinions saying that, well, this is coming, but only in the early days. And not so much for Brandeis. It was more from Frankfurter as he turned to the right, as he became more and more conservative. He had been appointed as a decidedly liberal justice. And when other people on the Warren Court and other liberals were upset with his decisions, there was an undertone of anti-Semitism there sometimes as well.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Yes. One question.
Which of the justices did you find the most fascinating to research and why?
Oh, that's a good question. How do I answer that in less than a half an hour or 20 minutes? Well, it's fantastic. First of all, I grew up knowing some of Steve Breyer's family, and my father knew his father, and so I was always interested in Steve Breyer, and, you know, his brother, by the way, one of the photos in my book is with his brother, Chuck, Federal Judge Charles Breyer, and it's one of the few cases in American history where he was appointed, where you have a sitting Supreme Court justice who has, throughout most of his tenure, a brother sitting on the federal court. And by the way, Stephen Breyer used to recuse himself from every case that his brother had. But I guess the most fascinating, I mean, Steve Breyer because of the local dimension. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is fascinating because she overcame a lot of things. By the way, she and my wife, a generation or two apart, went to the same high school. And by the way, she went to, if any of you are from New York, Madison High School, which claims as other alumni Bernie Sanders and Chuck Schumer. And Carole King, the singer, too, which is neither here nor there. But so it's somewhat of a distinguished alumnus group. But no, she's very interesting because she confronted a great deal. Oh, and I have to leave you with the last thing. If I have three more minutes, but that goes to your question, why I find Ruth Bader Ginsburg so interesting. And she was known for her great, as a voice of civility on the court. Her closest friend on the court for so many years was Antonin Scalia. Now, she was the most liberal justice on the court, and Justice Scalia, for 30 years, the most conservative. How did this happen? Okay. They met in the 1970s when they were both law professors. They hit it off intellectually. They then served on the D.C. Court of Appeals. They became the greatest of friends. They and their spouses spent every New Year's Eve together for 30 years. They vacationed together. Part of their friendship, and then I'll conclude on this note, came from a love of opera. They both, and I have one of my wonderful photos in my book, is in the 1994, they were extras in the Washington National Opera production of one of Richard Strauss's operas. And they were both in their 18th century opera garb, and they loved this. Now, what I have said in the book, and I say it again, in an age like our own, where there's so much polarization and dysfunction throughout American government and public life, it's really a wonderful story to have two justices who disagreed on everything, politically and ideologically, and yet their friendship and that of their families transcended their disagreements. And I think that's a model, hopefully, God willing, for the future, whether it will be or not. But that's so a great admiration. And I must say, I'm not a big fan of, if I say honestly, of Antonin Scalia, but he gets some credit for this too, because he was criticized a lot. You know, she was criticized. Her liberal supporters could not understand this. Neither could his liberal critics. So it says something about how sometimes friendship can transcend politics. And I give her some credit for that.
And thank you. It's very valuable to have that possibility out there.
Yeah, at least in theory.
Yeah. So thank you very much. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 115 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming, David.
And George, thank you for organizing this and arranging this.
And if anyone would like to buy the book is right out in front. And David, you are willing to sign?
I would be happy to sign it.
All right.
Any books.
Thank you very much.
More than happy.